This is Jason McKenna from Radio Verulam 92.6 FM, and I'm here once again getting the answers to your questions from our local MPs. However, if you've not been lucky enough to get your question answered this month, don't despair. They'll be back again next month fielding your questions with me. So that means you can email me through this month at jason.mckenna@radioverulam.com, or alternatively, you can DM our social medias and we'll endeavour to get your questions answered. Today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to local MP Bim Afolemi to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky enough to get an answer from Bim this time, he will be back again next month. But Bim, we spoke to you at the start of the month and it seems to have been a very, very busy return back to Parliament from recess, but you've been focusing on a lot of measures, some affecting the whole of the country, some for local areas as well. But can you explain some of the ideas of this economic plan post-lockdown that you've been kind of talking about through this month? Can you explain some of the core ideas and how this would affect your constituents and the people of Hertfordshire as a whole?
Great, thanks very much, and it's a pleasure to be here as always. So yes, I think that the first thing to be clear about, and I've been clear about this since May and June, when we've, you know, at the end of the first sort of lockdown period, so to speak, is that the health crisis of COVID is big, but it will pass and we will get through it and it will be over at some point soon, and I hope in the next few months. However, the economic damage is going to be much longer lasting. It's going to be structural. It's going to be incredibly difficult over a much longer period of time. And I've been focusing a lot of my time using my own experience and understanding and expertise from sort of working the city before I became elected, and understanding corporate law and finance to think about what we need to do. And working with the government, the Chancellor, Downing Street, various other people in Parliament to try and get some of those measures worked on. I think that there are a couple of key things. The first is fundamentally we need to reduce the debt that companies and individuals have had to take on to get through this. I don't think it's sustainable for that debt to just grow and grow and grow. And I think that we need to do that sooner rather than later. The Chancellor, as I'm speaking to you, has just made an announcement in the House of Commons where unfortunately I couldn't be today because we couldn't get everybody in because the House of Commons had to change its rules for social distancing. So you could, not as many people as usual can get in. But I've just been reading the Chancellor's made an announcement with a new, what he's called, new job support scheme, which will help viable jobs continue after the end of the furlough scheme. He's also extended the period of time that the sort of bounce back loans and various other debt measures that we introduced in the first lockdown, extended the repayment period of that to almost doubling it from 6 years to 10 or 11 years, I think. And that will make a difference. And also allowing some people to just pay back the interest on that rather than pay back the principal as well. That'll make it a lot more easy, a lot easier for people to pay that debt. So I think the one thing we need to do is reduce the debt. The second thing we need to do is we really need a green recovery. Now, people bandy this term around, and to be honest, it's not very clear what it means. What it means, in my view, is we need to help people get jobs in industries and in sectors that are not going to effectively be shut down because of their impact on global warming. Preferably be jobs that help with the challenges of global warming. And the way we do that is by doing everything from making electric cars cheaper, making training more available and affordable for people to retrain out of certain industries into other ones. We need to encourage better use of road space, not just in big cities, but in places like Harpenden and St Albans, encourage better use of road space so that cycling is an easier, more viable option for people. Because actually, if you're on a very busy road, a lot of people don't want to cycle along a really, really busy road for various obvious reasons. So I think that we need to focus now on a green recovery. So the first thing is we need to reduce people's debt burden. And the second thing is we need to focus on green jobs, a green recovery, which I think economically can really help us. And those are the sorts of jobs that in this area people can get. They often have, this area is one of the best educated areas in the whole country. So people's ability to switch out of the job they're doing into different ones is greater than it is for most people. Is also in an area that's very well connected with London, with the Midlands, both by road and rail. So again, there's a wide variety of places there people can work. And, you know, so that's the sort of stuff that I've been working on.
Focus on one of your big speeches this month, Beyond Fetcher, a new Conservative economic plan. You actually gave a little bit of a warning that we do have a rapidly aging population in the UK. You explained that by 2066, we will see 26% of the population being 65 or over. And you explained that it will have demands on the public purse, but you also are worried a bit about innovation. However, my question to you is about the Conservative immigration policy. Is it counterintuitive to have a more of a shutdown on people coming into this country? Because this week I talked to liberal thinker and economist Johan Norberg, who explained that the post-Brexit economy needs to be as open as possible to allow these new ideas in. So how will Britain post-lockdown and post-Brexit tap into this global brain power?
Very good question. The answer is that you do need to be open. You do need to be open to people, talented people from around the world. I think the question around immigration is one of who comes in, really. And what we've got to be is as open as possible for talented people to come from all over the world. The government's been very clear about that. They've established something which, to be honest, hasn't really got very much attention, but it has been announced. And I've been doing some work on it with Number 10 Downing Street. In fact, I'm in a meeting, I'm talking about it tomorrow, is something called the Office for Talent. Now, the Office for Talent is a new, you know, it's a new institution. It will start small, and it's designed to encourage talented people, entrepreneurs, scientists, academics, thinkers, you name it, to come to this country and make this country their home and do that in a welcoming, positive way. And I think that's a tacit admission that a lot of our immigration system is not seen by many people as welcoming and positive. And I think that that's regrettable and we need to work on that. But at the same time, you are right. For us to flourish, we're going to need more ideas, more innovation, more dynamism, and that can be helped by bringing in talented people from abroad. And you'll never hear me say anything other than that.
Now, also in this speech, you talk about the need to decarbonise quickly and to raise funds too because of the pressure on the purse. Would a carbon tax, is that on the cards to incentivise change?
Yeah, so the thing about a carbon tax is you are always going to have to end up with one. It is inevitable. The difficulty, and if it's so inevitable and so obvious, then why are we not doing it? The problem is working out what price of carbon should be, because we don't live in an economic island. We live in a physical island, but we don't live in an economic island. So if you were to impose a carbon tax in this country that was greater than the cost of carbon in other countries, you would severely disadvantage your business. If you were to impose one that had it lower than the price of carbon in other countries, then you would be encouraging more carbon in the UK. So in effect, it's very, very difficult to set a price. That's really the problem with a carbon tax. The way you can do that is you can allow the market to set a price, as markets do in all different sectors. But for that market to function properly, you need enough of the world to be part of it. And the truth is that the Americans and Chinese would be key in that. And if the Americans and Chinese cannot be part of it, it would have no effect because they're such big economies that it would be almost irrelevant unless you could get both of them to be part of it. And it'll be no surprises to anybody listening that America and China are not getting on terribly well at the moment. And, you know, Donald Trump is sort of an embarrassment as a president, and his attitude to these matters is pretty, I think it's fair to say, not very enlightened. So therefore, at the moment, the carbon tax is really hard. So what can you do in the meantime? I think we need to do a couple of things. The first thing is I think we need to be braver around where we raise taxes and where we raise money. And the principle should be in areas where people are doing things we do not want them to do is what I call the smoking principle, right? You raise taxes on smoking. You don't outlaw smoking, you just make it expensive to smoke. And what you do is you simultaneously, you raise money in the short term whilst there's a behavioral change going on. Over time, fewer and fewer people smoke. Now, I think we should be doing that around large areas of life. I think we should be doing that around flying. I think we should be doing it around cost of fuel. Rather, you look at the cost of fuel more broadly and transport being the broader point, and then plow that money in directly into getting the cost of electric vehicles down, expanding the charge points. I think I've talked to you before about expanding charge points all over this constituency, but obviously it's not just this constituency, across the country. And so that's the sort of thing I think we should be doing, and we've got to do it sooner rather than later.
One thing that maybe you think should happen really soon is you gave a speech about the Conservative Party having lost a bit of its identity. So what kind of facets do you think you have lost? And also, in my latest interview with Deputy Leader of the Lib Dems, Daisy Cooper, she expressed the same opinion and said that she would not do a deal with the Conservatives because of this. So is the party looking to change onto some of the ideas that you're proposing?
Put it this way. If you were to say to people 10 years ago, say when David Cameron was Prime Minister, that the Conservative Party would get its greatest increase in support amongst some of the poorest people in this country, in the poorest regions of this country, people would think you were mad. But that's exactly what we did at the last election. So why does that matter? It matters, and by the way, not just in regional terms, in my constituency, some of the biggest increases in support for the Conservative Party came amongst some of the poorest people in the constituency, and I know that. So that's happening all over the country. So what does that mean politically? It means that the party needs to pay greater attention than we have over, say, the past 10, 15 years, to the needs of poorer people, because they are, in many ways, have the toughest lives of people in the country. And we need to make sure we focus our policies on them. And I think that that is something that we're doing. And in terms of the speech I made, we're losing identity. That wasn't quite what I said. What I said was, Margaret Thatcher was very, very clear about the needs of her time, and what the Conservative Party needed to do at that time was to change its focus to really market economics and deal with the problems of the unions and deal with the problems of high inflation. And that's what we did in the 80s and 90s. Now we have a different set of problems. And rather than just repeating what we did in the 80s and 90s, we need to have a new approach. And that's a new approach focused on a better functioning state. It's a focus on climate change in the way that I described earlier. It's a focus on making sure that we have a fully enterprise nation and building up our small medium-sized businesses and improving productivity. That's what the Conservative Party's focus needs to be. And that also will have the benefit of helping some of the poorest people in this country the most. So that's why. That's how we should focus it. And the Prime Minister's sort of levelling up agenda is an umbrella of under which these sort of ideas can come. And over the next months and years, you know, people like you will judge whether we've managed to do it properly or not. You know, if we haven't, then, you know, we'll lose and we won't improve things. If we have, then we'll win again and people will say that we've improved country for the better. You know, we will see.
Nationwide as well, you haven't just been focusing on economics, you've also been focusing on some issues that have really affected people, which, you know, aren't always seen when these kind of pandemics or certain problems arise. So you're one of the MPs that have actually been representing more accessible face masks, the clear face masks for people with hearing problems. Will these be deployed in public roles and Parliament as well?
Yes. So I have, and this I think it's a small issue, but it really matters. When we first, and forgive me, I can't remember exactly when this was, but it was a few months ago where face masks became mandatory in shops and other and public transport. I received two emails from constituents who were hard of hearing and explained to me how scared they would be about just functioning, not being able to see people's faces or mouth. Now, I have to be honest, before I received these emails, I hadn't even considered that having face masks would have a negative impact. You know, maybe I should have known that. I didn't know that. And then I remembered that there's a member of my constituency who lives in Hitchin. She actually works for the National Deaf Society, and we were in touch, and I've dealt with her on many issues before. And then that was really how this whole thing came about. So I just think that having clear face masks makes a big difference. I've only got one. I need to see if I can get another one, because I don't know about you, but these things get steamed up and they get a bit manky. So you've got to make sure you've got more than one of them. So at the moment, I'm going to have to, you know, get another one. But I think it's really, really important that as many people as possible, particularly people in public authority, whether it be, you know, the person on the train who's the guard on the train, or the shopkeeper, if we can have clear face masks, it can just make it that much easier for people who are hard of hearing, who have a really tough and alienating time anyway, make it easier for them to function about their day-to-day lives.
Talking about steaming up, it does steam up my glasses, these face masks. So.
I know, glasses are miserable with them. I know, completely miserable.
You're talking about clearing up a problem there nationwide, but also closer to home. You've been working really on a big problem of increased litter in your constituency since the start of lockdown. What are the reasons why there's been this increase? And also, you're actually on the front line here. You're doing a little pick in Hitchin on Friday, taking a hands-on approach. What else is being done for this problem?
I am slightly bemused by this, because I don't really know why it has increased. I've got a few theories as to why, but it puzzles me at a time when everybody has been talking about how important communities are and the strength of community bonds, that at that precise time, we've seen a big increase in the amount of litter all over the constituency, and of fly tipping as well. Fly tipping on a sort of industrial scale, I think part of it is because of the reduced availability of tips and things because of COVID. And I think that hopefully that is being dealt with as now we expand the times that they are open, and we're doing that. But, you know, for me, litter, what I would encourage anybody who's listening to this to do is this. If they see people dropping litter, I think the most powerful deterrent is from your fellow citizen, is people saying, don't do that. Shaming people has a very positive effect. And at the same time, if you do see people doing it, not just shame them, but, you know, show other people, say, look, you shouldn't be doing that. I'm not one of these people that think, you know, you can't ring up the police for someone dropping a piece of litter on the road. I just don't think that's feasible. But I do think as a community, we should make it unacceptable, a bit like it's unacceptable to, you know, throw a cigarette butt in someone's direction, for example. That's just regarded as unacceptable. We should make it unacceptable to throw litter. We should make it unacceptable to do lots of other things, you know. So I think that the power of shaming can be powerful. In the meantime, high profile litter picks, I'm doing them, there'll be others, and I'll continue doing them, can also just remind everybody that it's a real issue and a real problem.
Yeah, I've seen it in my area as well. You know, a lot of people throwing the face masks off as well, which, you know, kind of undoes the point, because you're trying to keep everybody safe, and then if somebody has to pick up your face mask, it could infect them with COVID. So it's a big strong message to kind of keep on top of cleaning your area. But before we move into the community questions, one of the big things that you've been doing this month, and one of the most heartbreaking things for your constituents but nationwide alike, is the stories of people during giving birth that they've had to do it alone during this lockdown period. But you've been working with fellow MP Alicia Kearns for better lockdown maternity rights. What progress has been made so far?
Pretty good progress on this. So is the first thing to say why this is important. So I have got three small children, which is wonderful and joyous all the time. now, my last son, I've got three sons. My last one was born about 18 months ago. But one thing that I would really say, as somebody who, you know, I wasn't somebody that would have necessarily recognized the importance of somebody being there whilst a mother's giving birth. Again, I'm not pretending that I always felt like this or always thought about it. I never did. But you realize the loneliness, particularly during COVID, when you can't have the big group of family come over, you know, afterwards, the loneliness of the whole thing and the fact that it is quite, you know, can quite often be, you know, dangerous, and it can be, you know, difficult and painful and all the things that we appreciate. So what we have to make sure is that people give, mothers giving birth can have their partner, or indeed anybody they choose. I don't, you know, it doesn't have to be a particular partner, of course. It can be a mother, a sister, you know, a friend. But I think that to have that is really, really important. The health secretary, I spoke with Alicia, my colleague, the health secretary is very sympathetic. The prime minister is very sympathetic. The difficulty is that some NHS trusts have refused to change their policy. And so what we're trying to do is to make sure that all NHS trusts change their policy. We've got some of the way, but we're not there yet. But, you know, I have simply supported this campaign. You know, Alicia Kearns is the one who's really worked on it. She's driven it. I've supported her. And it's a good example of the advantage of being in government and being an MP of the governing party, because when you actually have an issue, you know, and this is something that I think people really don't always recognize, is that when there's an issue, when it's the governing party, you can just speak to your colleagues and deal with it. And you speak to each other, your friends, you know each other very well. When it's opposition MPs, they don't have that level of access. And so it's a real advantage to be a member of the governing party. And of course, by the way, you know, if at the next election Labour to win, it would be an advantage for Labour MPs, you know, in that context as well. But I do think it's a real, it's a benefit. We've really been able to help that campaign.
Do you have like a time period of where you expect to kind of give people a little bit of hope of when we can see possible kind of inclusion of partners, as you said, friends, or just a supportive person there with people during that?
I don't know, but what I do know is that the health secretary is fully behind it, as is Department of Health. So I'm hoping that this is a sort of days rather than weeks or months issue.
Now, as always with these discussions, Radio Verulam is here to help the community, and we called for questions for you, Bim. So let's move it into what the people of the area want to know. And I do actually have to start here with a couple of difficult questions for you, Bim. Starts in regard to the aforementioned Clear Blue Beyond Thatcher economic talk. Now, some people were left upset and felt a joke that you made towards the end of discussions were a bit insensitive. But would you like to offer a bit of an explanation there, Bim?
Well, just to say that I think the interviewer said something to me about I think it was in the context of the, because of people not commuting or traveling to work so much, villages and small towns were having an increase in spending locally. And that's true. In fact, The Economist magazine interviewed me about this last week, and I gave a quote to them, which is in last week's Economist. And that's true. And then he said something like, oh, you know, it was a, you know, therefore almost implying as a joke that COVID was somehow had helped leveling up through that, because obviously a part of the leveling up process is a policy is that we help small towns and villages. And I laughed and went along with the joke. And obviously anybody who watched that knows that that was the provenance of it. And of course, nobody thinks that the health crisis is in any way amusing. In fact, you know, my father's a local NHS doctor, my mum's a local pharmacist, who incidentally both had COVID, both recovered. But, you know, so the idea that you know, that I found that amusing is just completely untrue. And to be honest, I think it's, you know, and this happens when you're in politics, is that there were, you know, a couple of sort of opposition party activists who spend a lot of time following every word you make and then trying to find things, you know, to catch you out on or to you know, and this is just part of politics, but I think anybody that knows me or anybody that's seen any of my work or seen anything I've done knows that there's no offence intended at all.
Now, also, we've had a few residents kind of voice their concerns about your role with Time Partners in a consultancy role. What assurances can you give to them, your constituency as a whole, that this new part-time role will not distract from your MP work, and maybe an insight into actually this being quite a common ministerial practice?
Yeah, so first of all, I only did that for 1 month. But more importantly, the broader, so I'm not doing it at the moment. The broader point, though, is that in this country, we have always had a system whereby MPs have often done other things. Some of those things are paid outside things. Some of them are unpaid. Most of the things I do are unpaid. So I sit on the court of the University of Bedfordshire. I'm a member of the Ditchy Foundation, a think tank. I trustee of several charities. All of those things take quite a lot of time. And I spent, when I first was elected, I worked on a, I think it was sort of 2 hours a week, with an organization promoting the interests of the self-employed. I also have sat, you know, on my previous career, I've been involved with small businesses as well. And that's always been our tradition in this country. And it's very, very important. Indeed, the leader of the opposition himself, Keir Starmer, until he became leader of the opposition, regularly worked as a lawyer, regularly giving advice to different clients. And he did that. In fact, I think he's actually done a little, I think he's done even a couple of very small things whilst he's been leader, though, you know, I doubt he necessarily does at the moment. So I suppose my broader point is, it's very, very important for MPs to get access and to be connected with the outside world, both in a paid or non-paid way, but you are still a full-time member of parliament. These are things that happen in your spare time. And it's very, very important that we don't stop that. There are, I have colleagues, as I say, Keir Starmer, who worked as a lawyer. There are others who work as lawyers in spare time. There are doctors, there are business people, people who run their own businesses, keep their businesses going, people who work for charities. Yeah, there's a full range. And of course, when someone becomes a minister, they're a minister of the Crown working in a department as Minister for X or Secretary of State for Y, and they remain as constituency MPs as well. So the Chancellor, who is, you know, along with the Prime Minister, one of the busiest people in Britain probably, is also a constituency MP, as indeed is the Prime Minister. You know, so in our system, that's always been the way we do things. There are some people who think that you should have ministers that are not MPs, and that's a, you know, that's what they have in a country like America. It's a fair system, but that is not what we have. We have a parliamentary system. We don't have a president.
Do you think it's a little catch-22 situation because people want ministers and representing their views, but then also people kind of have the criticism that, oh, a lot of ministers are career politicians and never had experience. Is this kind of a way to make sure that ministers actually do know what is going on in the, in air quotes, real world?
I mean, one of the things about politics, right, is that people will always find a reason to criticize what you do because that's just the nature of politics. And it's not new. It's probably been that way for hundreds of years. The same people that will often criticize somebody for doing something as well as being a member of parliament are often the same people who say, oh, I don't like all these career politicians. I mean, you can't have it both ways. And I think that one of the strengths of our system is that we have people who are MPs and also find time to do other voluntary, and as I repeat, you know, most of the things that I do that are not just being an MP are unpaid. You know, they are, you know, involved with the University of Bedfordshire and indeed the University of Hertfordshire. I forgot to mention them, and I don't want to upset anybody by forgetting the University of Hertfordshire as well. Working with those universities, with various charities and the like, it's important that we keep that tradition in this country because we have never had a political class in the traditional sense. We have always had, our tradition is that someone is in a constituency, they go to Westminster, and that person is rooted in the world and rooted in society and rooted in this country, not just the people that go from Westminster, go from university, they advise politicians in Westminster, get a seat, and their entire world is Westminster. And then we often wonder why, you know, you can't get people into politics. It's because, you know, it's people are not attracted to a world where the only, your whole, you have to live in a sort of monastic political world. I think it's so important and vital that you have a foot in what's really, really going on in the country. And I think that's very important.
Now, Michael's messaging about the new Track and Trace app. He's asked, have you had experience using it? And what has the feedback been so far amongst constituents?
I've downloaded it, but I haven't really used it yet, if that makes sense. So I have downloaded it, though I've given my Track and Trace details in every single bar or pub that I've, you know, restaurant I've been into over the last, you know, few weeks or so. The feedback, I haven't had much beyond some people telling me that they had sort of, they were going to download it. I don't know whether people think it's good or not. I've really no idea. On some level, maybe it's too early to say. It's disappointed me it's taken us this long. I would have liked us to have got this up and running, the app faster, but we are where we are. It's there now. And the way how this can work, the way how this will have the most benefit is for as many people as possible to download the app. Because if people download it, it will have more contacts, more information, and that'll help us all get back to normal faster and more effectively.
Quite a few people have sent in a message about the change of tact in government in the Brexit deal. Some people have voiced their concerns about potentially breaking international law by amending this Brexit withdrawal bill. What assurances can you give to people about this process and also over the fact that hopefully we do not see a no-deal Brexit?
Yeah, so the Internal Markets Bill basically is about binding the union more closely together and making sure that you have the freest internal United Kingdom market possible. In relation to the bits, which I strongly support, and I made a speech about it in the House, in relation to the bits that were alleged to contravene international law, I think that the best way of describing it is the following. In effect, there were certain things in the Northern Ireland Protocol that meant that the European Union, there was a debate around if we did not come to a full trade deal at the end of the year, because if we do, then frankly, these points will be irrelevant. If we did not, there was an argument about who would determine certain things between the European Union and United Kingdom. The European Union, in their negotiations with the United Kingdom over the trade deal, said that they were unilaterally going to determine certain rules around state aid, so that's aid to businesses, certain rules around exports from Northern Ireland to GB in particular. So what we have said is, in the event of no trade deal, we will determine, a Minister of the Crown will determine those rules. The European, and under the terms of the protocol, there is a legal argument that says that if the UK were to determine them and the EU had not agreed them, then we may have contravened the Northern Ireland Protocol. And that's an international agreement. However, this would only even come into force after we'd exhausted all the provisions under the protocol, we'd gone to arbitration as well. And after that, if we still didn't have a deal with the European Union, we've taken the decision that we should maintain the unity and complete freedom within the United Kingdom. And I think that that's the right decision.
Now, another question from a constituent, Marco. He says, Bim, your own profile statement is to care for the vulnerable, but you're one of the 300 MPs who voted down an amendment which would have implemented the recommendations of the Grenfell disaster. Is this representative of your view and aim to help the vulnerable? Is this something that you honestly do not believe should be implemented, or is it representative in any way of your constituents' beliefs?
That particular vote was an example of what oppositions do in politics. So we are implementing the results of the Grenfell report. We're doing all of those things. What the Labour Party's amendment did was to effectively try and force the government to do things in a different way from the order in which we wanted to do them and the way in which the government chose to do them. So it's a debate around exactly how we implement things. It's not a debate about whether you implement it at all. And one of the dangers, I'm afraid, with newspapers is that people have people can sometimes believe what they say around why you vote in a particular way on some certain thing. And even the way how motions are sometimes worded in Parliament can be very, very misleading. And that's, I don't blame anybody for being misled by them, because, you know, they're not in Parliament, they don't know what's going on. But really, we are fully, fully committed to implementing the work on Grenfell, and we're going to continue doing that.
Katie has pointed out something that is really worrying her, and she's asking, what is his party and specifically the government going to do about the state of British rivers? She explains that everyone fails EU environmental standards. Why have prosecutions by the Environmental Agency for discharging sewage, farm effluent and chemical pollution fallen so dramatically in the last 10 years?
I'm afraid I don't know. I'm happy to go and find out. I think it's a really good question. I really don't know the answer to it. The Environment Agency, I think its performance is a bit bitty. I think it's fair to say I'm not having a go at any individual in the Environment Agency. As an institution, I do think they do need some improvement. I've had dealings with them in many different areas, in particular around chalk streams, which I've recently been working with fellow Hertfordshire MP Sir Charles Walker, who's MP for Broxbourne, Sir Oliver Heald, who's my neighbour in North East Hertfordshire as well, on helping our chalk streams recover, which is sort of a unique ecological feature. And so I've had dealings with the Environment Agency over that. I've had dealings with them and talked to them about their dealing with the building of new nuclear power stations. And I think that their performance has been pretty woeful in that as well. So I don't want to say that this is their fault in this context, because I just don't know the answer. But you know, the Environment Agency does need, you know, a bit of reform, and I think we do need new leadership, and we need to make sure that we're taking all the steps we can, because what that constituent describes is just not good enough.
Natasha has also got an environmental concern, but this is probably a long-running one. It's about Luton Airport flights and the noise over Harpenden. She said she knows this is an old question, but she'd like a definitive answer and some help on this. She explains that the residents of Harpenden want pollution and noise to be reduced, as this is something that has been forced upon them under the banner of progress, development and need. She expressed the point that at the very least, she'd like some of these late flights kind of reduced, because they're making noise as late as 2 a.m.
She's right. And I have, since I was elected in 2017, been completely clear. At the last general election, I was also very clear that I think Luton Airport should, first of all, not expand. And secondly, we should get rid of night flights. I've been very, very clear about that. I will continue to be clear about that. I've said it in the House of Commons. I've said it in public. I'll continue to say it. Luton Airport, or rather Luton Borough Council, the owners of Luton Airport, have one interest in mind, and that is making money for Luton Borough Council. They have absolutely no concern about the citizens of Harpenden or Wheatamstead or Sandridge and other areas in the constituency that get flown over by planes. And I will continue pushing this, and as I say, campaigning to make sure Luton Airport does not expand.
Personal trainer Chris has messaged in, and he wanted to ask if you were surprised at how well gyms have performed since being reopened. Also, because of the good conduct and the way that they've kept their premises clean, he wanted to know, will they be kept open for as long as possible? He mentions the fact that gym equipment is cleaned by him and other staff members 200 plus times a day.
200 times a day? He didn't say 20, 200. Gosh, that's extraordinary. Well, all I can say is, am I surprised? No, I'm not, because my experience of gyms which is, you know, a bit more limited than it used to be, is that they're run by some very, very effective, intelligent, hardworking people. And they are doing their best to make sure their business can keep going and making sure people can stay fit. And I'm not surprised that that people want to keep going to their gym, and some people probably want to even go more because they felt they've been sitting around so much over lockdown. So I'm not surprised, but I am surprised that they managed to clean 200 times a day. I mean, I just, hats off to them, because it's not an easy thing and it's time consuming and difficult. So well done them. And yeah, I think things need to stay open as long as possible. I've been very, I was on BBC Look East, I think it was yesterday or the day before, making the point that we need to keep the economy moving through this period of time. I am not one of those people who thinks that we need to just do a second lockdown, because lockdowns cost lives too. And so keeping things moving is really important. That's one of the reasons why I was one of the people talking to Prime Minister, Health Secretary and others before the Prime Minister's announcement on Monday, over the weekend and before that, saying that we needed a proportionate response that could be sustainable over a period of time. I think the Prime Minister has definitely done that. If we keep to these rules, keep things going, we can get through the next difficult few months without imposing these sort of long, difficult lockdowns, which I think are very, very damaging indeed. So, you know, gyms are a very key part of society and the economy. We need to keep them open.
I suppose the personal point for you is you probably kept fit and healthy and have your home gym with your young children. They probably keep you very in shape.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, exactly. They've just got these laser gun things. And they're these guns that sort of, they're not real guns, might I add, guys. I wouldn't give my kids real guns. These are laser guns. And they're great. You run around the house or you run around the garden and fire at each other. And that's quite good for fitness. But to be honest, you know, I'm blessed that being in Parliament every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, sometimes Fridays, you know, Parliament's very big, you spend a huge amount of time walking around. And that in and of itself, my average steps are something like 14,000 a day, simply being in or around Parliament. So it's quite active as well. So I'm very lucky in that score.
And on the final community question here, this is a topic, you know, to do with fitness, to do with health, but also the health of the area. Nigel has pointed out that you gave direct backing to our local football club, Hitchin Town FC, for funding. Did your footballing history come into this thinking, or is it because football clubs are such big, important institutions of local areas?
Both. So I contributed to the crowdfunder for Hitchin Town. And I did this for two reasons. Well, three. One is I love football. Two, they're really important to Hitchin and they're important to a lot of people. And as a local MP, you've always got to support something that is very, very important to local people, regardless of whether you like football or not. That's the second thing. And the third thing is I'm really, really excited because if you gave £100 or more, you can get your name on next year's shirt. And so I've never had my name on a proper club football shirt. And so the prospect of this was too much to miss.
And what number are you going to have on the back of it as well?
Oh, I don't know. No. So the official club shirt. So it's, so, you know, they'll have, I don't know, 100 names on it or whatever, or 50 names on the back. And so your name can be one of those if you've given £100 or more to the crowdfunder.
Goodness.
So, right. And they've raised a huge amount of money, and it just shows, I know, having spoken to the club, they were bowled over by the support of the local community. And what I'm hoping is that once we're through all this, more people will go and watch the games, you know, on a Saturday. And I think that'd be a great outcome.
And I think we've had a great outcome here today, Bim. So I just have to thank you for your time today again, Bim.
No problem. Thank you.
And for those who didn't have their question answered this month, Bim will be returning next month to answer them once again.